to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly of Writing in Academia, a podcast where three writing nerds discuss the joys and jitters of writing in a research context. So we're going to talk about writing a peer review today.
Great.
Scary.
It's hard, isn't it?
At least receiving it is scary.
Receiving it is scary, but that means that it's good to know how to write a good one so that, you know, your peer review karma is on the plus side.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it will be a little bit on writing and also receiving, right?
I think so, yeah.
We've thought about it that way.
Well, thinking, using how you want to receive feedback as a way of informing how you give feedback. So putting yourself in the author's shoes a little bit.
Yeah.
Walking.
As a reviewer.
Yeah.
I guess we should start by talking a little bit about why we even do peer review.
That's the question, isn't it?
Does it improve?
Why do you invite people to complain about your work like that?
Exactly, to criticize.
Yeah.
It's a bit my like, work.
Yeah.
Yeah, why not just post it online?
I remember when I was a PhD student, you know, the first times you were exposed to this process, I thought it was really, you know, I was really put off by you know, some complete stranger is telling me what's bad about my paper and so on. But I think the more times you go through it, the older I get, the more you realize that it's a necessary part for improving the paper so that you actually convey the message that you were planning to convey, because they see it with fresh eyes. And, you know, they can tell me things that I've missed in the manuscript. So it's really about improving the quality as far as I see.
It's about, yeah, improving the quality. I mean, checking the research, but also improving the quality in terms of it actually saying something to an audience. So your peer reviewer is the first audience.
And I mean, it is sort of the foundation upon which science is built, right? A community of peers who scrutinize each other's work and check whether it's reproducible by reproducing it later on, and making sure that anything that gets out there is some sort of claim of we think we know this thing.
Yeah.
It holds water.
Yeah. It's not foolproof, of course, but...
Of course not. Of course not. In your fields, is peer review blind, double blind?
It's not double blind in the sense, I mean, an author, I never see who gives me the comments, of course.
Yeah.
But they sometimes they try to make it anonymous for the reviewers by not, I mean, they don't put the author's names on the manuscript, but there's always a corresponding author somewhere in the manuscript. So, so it's sort of,
Or you have something like, you know, we have previously shown X, and then a citation that is obviously that author.
Yeah.
And Evan, you're in which field again?
Combustion engines.
Yeah, just for, you know, if we have new listeners.
Hey, welcome new listeners.
Yeah. Yeah, and in my field, linguistics, or applied linguistics, it's usually double blind. Yeah.
Okay.
So both are anonymous. Usually.
And in my field in chemistry, it was I didn't know who the reviewer was, but the reviewer knew who I was. Yeah. And the papers that I reviewed when I was a PhD student, I think I did two, maybe only one. I don't know. It was a long time ago. It was not double blind. I saw who it was.
Probably because, I mean, it's usually easy enough to find out who wrote the paper. You can Google the title, and maybe someone's presented it somewhere at a conference or...
For sure.
So maybe that's the reason why. But yeah, we do double blind in linguistics.
It'd be interesting to see if that corresponds to, if you can see if the level of politeness in the replies is, you know, it scales with, you know,
that's how, research in
how anonymous you are.
That's something we can do. Yeah.
Because sometimes the reviewers are not very polite, but you, when you reply to their comments, you're always very polite.
It's a good topic for a research paper in linguistics, I think. Politeness strategies in reviewing. And it's out there already, some sort of discourse analysis of this.
It's interesting because part of the idea of peer review is that it's supposed to be unbiased, right? It's supposed to be just based on the quality of the work presented in that paper, not based on who you are or where you come from or anything like that. But it's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm guilty.
We don't have
of that. Sometimes, you know, when I get an invitation for a peer review, I sort of look at, okay, that's a good group. Yeah, I'll take it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so, yeah. Wow. I don't know that I've ever thought about it that way, but yeah.
Now you're not supposed to do that, but you have a limited amount of time.
It makes you happy, I guess also because, you know, it's an unpaid thing doing peer review.
Yeah.
So you want to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and receive a good paper.
Mm-hmm.
More work if it's a paper that needs more work. It's more work for you as a reviewer. Yeah.
I'm reviewing conference abstracts right now, which isn't quite the same thing. It's a much shorter amount of text, but some of them I'm just like, pretty sure that was a random assignment. I have no knowledge of this weird aspect of the humanities.
So what
it's
do you
for
do
a scholarship
then?
Of teaching and learning. So for like the type of work, it's relevant for me. But I sent back. I was like, I could review this for SOTL purposes, scholarship of teaching and learning, if you need me to. But if you've got someone who's got a science paper who's not really clear on that and wants to switch, let me know because I'd much rather do science. We'll see what happens.
So that's an aspect as well.
Yeah. That happens to you as well. Sometimes I get, you know, review invitations. They ask me to review, but based on your expertise, we'd like you to review this paper on, and then it's something completely unrelated to what I do.
Well, you can say no.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's one of the good things about this system is that you can and should say no if you don't feel qualified.
But if we get down to what is actually there on paper, sort of what feedback would you like to get?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you, I mean, if you're on the receiving end, we've talked a little bit about being on the sort of sending end, but if you're on the receiving end, Øyvind.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I said, I see the peer review process as a part of the whole revision process. You start writing a very rough draft, and then you get feedback first from yourself because you're always critical of what you write, and then you give it to your co-authors and. Supervisors, if you're not a professor, you have a supervisor, and you get comments. So,
or some other poor person.
So this, the criticism that you, or the comments that you get, they get more and more distant from you throughout this process. And the peer review is the final test. You put the paper in the hands of someone who has no prior knowledge about your project and why you did this experiment. So that's the first person who reads it with fresh eyes. So the feedback I want is feedback that tells me if it works as a paper. Do they understand what I'm trying to send out there as a message? More than proofreading and things like that.
Yeah, no, certainly me too. I mean, I like feedback that tells me this is what I see in your paper, and this is what works, and this is what, you know, doesn't work. So if they see something. And that overlaps with what I wanted to say. Then I know I'm on the right track. And then maybe they say, okay, so we see this, but you do a poor job of actually discussing those points in your resultant discussion section. So we suggest maybe that you organize in a different way or something like that. If you know, if the paper fails down the line. But if they can say, if they see my main argument, then I know.
Yeah.
And if they don't see that, if they see something else, then I have to go back and think, okay, so I presented this, but they saw this or understood this. So
how could that be? Why could that have happened?
Exactly. Yeah.
I also really like it when I get comments on sort of how I could improve the paper. Sort of taking a writing instructor perspective, like almost like they're my teacher and I'm their student. It would be really cool if you incorporated this idea, or I'm not sure if it's relevant, but here's a cool paper that you might be interested in reading. Of course, hopefully not your own paper, as in you should cite me, your reviewer.
Exactly.
That happens.
Yeah.
That happened to me with my first paper when I was a PhD student. But that's sort of like suggestions for improvement. How could you, even if it's not a requirement to get published in this journal, how could you take your paper to the next level?
Exactly. Yeah.
But that's not easy feedback to give, is it? That's really hard feedback to give.
Yeah.
What's easy? I mean, easy is like correcting grammar mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, on line 7 on page 8, you have a spelling error.
Or just simply saying, this is unclear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know.
have it edited by a native speaker of English.
Yeah.
Any horror stories of peer reviews that you've received before we start talking more concretely about what you should do? What not to do's?
Once I got, you know, a review by, because you want to assume that the reviewers are experts and they really know what they're talking about. But sometimes you get reviews from people who just don't get it. I mean, it could be the problem with how you write the paper, but Sometimes it's just a problem of a sloppy review. So once we wrote a paper that was, it was really a scientific experiment. We were trying to figure out a flame stabilization mechanism on a burning diesel spray by, you know, forcing ignition with a laser or plasma. So it was really, you know, just to test a hypothesis in a very strange setup, just to test this theoretical idea. And then you get this review back from someone who says, this is never going to work in an engine.
I've decided it's not worth testing it.
Yeah. Okay, did you read the paper? Or
so decided sort of, just looking at it. No. That will never work.
Yeah.
Of course, I mean, at conferences, I think we've all had those comments coming from someone who say, okay, so you think you can do this, but no.
No,
it's not going to work. No.
That's pretty frustrating, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, my God. What about you, Lena?
Well, I've had reviews with sort of just bullet points and not, you know, reviews that just say, okay, so this is fine, but one would wish for more.
Mm.
Or one could wish for more. And then I'm thinking, okay,
what
do you wish for? So it's this sort of unclear.
Just more pages, more words.
Yeah, more pages, more clarity, more theory. You know what?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's. But horror stories. I don't have any horror stories. Mm. I have some sort of nasty comments where I could see that the reviewer had done this 1 a.m. in the morning, and probably just tired. And I saw from the beginning to the end that it took them perhaps 20 minutes, and so not very nice. So politeness was not high. So the politeness strategies could have been better.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that was a bit disappointing. But usually, I think I can still get something out of it. So no horror stories. No.
I don't think I have any either. I mean, I haven't published as many papers as I could have. I was a pretty lazy grad student. But and changing disciplines really stops publication in its tracks, doesn't it?
Yeah. You have to figure out the new discipline.
Next year.
Yeah.
But I don't know. The peer reviews that I did get were critical, but they still managed to be concrete, I found.
Constructive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, maybe not always super constructive. Like, they weren't quite equipped to make suggestions. They were more like, this is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do that. Don't do this. Move this. Mm-hmm. But
change the color of the line in the graph.
I think the worst is if you don't get any comments, like overall comments.
Yeah.
Nowadays, usually these sort of forms that you need to fill in, they force you to do something, like the overall comment of the article, or what is the novelty in your, or what is the significance in your words. So reviewers are forced to actually articulating that. But if you get your article with the track changes thing, where reviewers, they've only sort of put, I don't know, exclamation marks in the margin, or this is unclear, or please rephrase, or, you know, comments like that.
Yeah.
That's fairly unhelpful.
Yeah.
Not super useful.
So that would be a horror story.
Should we, maybe we should jump into how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
We could talk a lot about horror stories and big stuff, but more concretely, we've sort of put together a bit of a step-by-step on how you might approach doing this, and this is sort of based on experience and different...
We haven't researched this. So
no, we haven't researched this so much, but I've worked freelance for a while as a developmental editor, which is kind of a cool job that looks at helping authors develop manuscripts so that the argument works. It's not language editing. It's the stage after language editing.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's that sort of, but also, you know, our experience, you as a professor, Eivind, having written probably a lot of papers, and Liana and me working with writing instruction as well, it's sort of it's a mishmash, I guess, of a writing teacher and practicing scientist.
Yeah, and some of those books wisdom out there as well, a few articles. So some of them might be best practice. We don't know.
Okay, well, let's dive in. I think the most important thing to start with is to figure out what you're supposed to do. I mean, you have a limited amount of time, a limited amount of energy, and this is a pro bono thing that you're not doing. You're not getting paid for it. So it's really important to read the guidelines, read the instructions, look at all the material available to you as a reviewer from the journal. Actually, maybe even like step zero, if that's step one, step zero is look at the paper carefully and consider whether or not you actually are equipped to review it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have the time to give to it? Do you have the energy to give to it, and do you have the expertise
before you answer
to be able to appraise that properly?
But that is also it comes down to your level of ambition, I think well, because it never says, you know, explicitly, at least not in my field, that you should check that the citations are correct, or I mean that, you know, the references are relevant for this and so on. So I never do that. But I know other people who do that. So they can spend a couple of days reviewing a paper, and it wouldn't be sustainable for me to.
No, I don't do that either.
No.
And I guess, I mean, sometimes you have to jump right in there, because if you feel that you're not confident, some of us have, you know, suffer from this imposter syndrome. So we think that we're, no, I'm not qualified to, I'm not an expert in this field, I cannot do it. But yeah, certainly read through it and see if you, you know, a general sense of, is this in my field or is it totally outside of my field? Sometimes you may get stuff like that because it's hard to get reviewers as well.
It's easier to say no up front, though, than it is to go back to the editor after a couple of days or a couple of weeks. If you're, you know, if they give you a month and you wait until week three to do it, go back to them and be like, actually,
now that I read it,
I can't. But assuming that you have accepted a paper that you're equipped to look at, it's that useful first step is reviewing the guidelines and setting up your review criteria and really making it clear. It's the same approach, I would say, that I would use if I were grading a stack of papers by students. What have I asked them for? And what am I looking for when I read through them?
And most journals have quite clear criteria nowadays. And review forms and
I mean, the smart authors will actually look at the peer review instructions as well when they're preparing a manuscript. To think, okay, how can I also tailor my manuscript to suit what the person judging it is going to be looking for?
So good advice for writers, for authors.
One of the things that I like to pay attention to, or actually clarify with an editor, is what's the difference between a major revision and a minor revision? Because it's crazy how different people's interpretations of these two things are. So why don't you guys start with telling me what you think?
Minor and major? I think minor would be if the main point, if the sort of, you know, the novelty and significance is there, and I buy the main argument, and the rest is, well, more of a structure thing, get the structure of the result in discussion, but not completely sort of turned over. But yeah, difficult, because sometimes, you know, even if you have your main argument and the novelty and significance, if all of your sections are jumbled and you don't see the storyline and all of the figures are, you know, well, maybe not commented on it even, then yeah, then that would be major revisions. But minor revision... Yeah, Evan, help me.
For me, it's superficial things. I mean, if you just need to polish up the language a bit, or I mean, you can read it, you can understand what they, and it's a sound. They make a sound argument and so on, but you're not happy with the editorial quality, for example. Then that's minor revisions.
So no for me. Reorganization. Minor revision.
Because if you need to reorganize the whole thing, then I think that's a major.
That's a major, yeah.
But you can, I mean, you can accept a paper with major revisions. But sometimes, you know, you get a paper that where the editorial quality is so poor that you don't understand what they're trying to, what is this about? And then I've just said, no, I think they have to start all over.
So it's a rejection.
Yeah.
So the way that I've tried to sort of rationalize this with myself is a minor revision has to do with the writing. And I come from an experimental field. So a minor revision has to do with the writing and major revision has to do with the experimental results.
Oh, okay. So they had to go back to the lab.
Yeah. So rejection is if like there's no chance that a couple of extra experiments could possibly salvage this piece. But the minor revision, even something like a structural reorganization, I would still put under, in my mind, a minor revision because that has to do with the writing.
So this is a huge difference to my field, where certainly the writing and the reorganization is probably the most important part. So that would certainly be a major revision. We might ask the author to go back and redo the experiment, but if so, I think it would be a rejection. You know, this resubmit.
I think so. Resubmit, yeah. Yeah. So, because it's in some fields, it's very difficult to go back. And, I mean, if you're doing nuclear physics, you have to get into a big lab somewhere and get beam time and so on.
Chemistry is a little easier with that, I guess. Yeah. It's not sort of about you have to redo the whole thing, because especially my type of materials chemistry, it's sort of like you synthesize a material and then you characterize it in a bunch of ways and you test its use for an application. And so it could be, for example, that there's a particular type of characterization that would have been important to be able to make a claim about the material properties, and they haven't done that characterization, but they still have their samples. Mm-hmm. Reasonably speaking, it should just mean doing like maybe an extra week's worth of lab work.
Yeah.
If there's a fatal flaw in the study and it means they have to start from scratch, then that would be reject because it's not good enough.
So I guess, our conclusion is that the major revision might mean a lot of things, and it's fairly wide. Some people might say major revision, and it's in my book, maybe that would be a minor revision, since my minor revision seemed to be a bit broader than yours. But yeah, so just be aware of that. And I usually tell our students, Jenny, that, if you get a major revision, that's good.
Yeah.
It's excellent. Yeah. Because
it's not a rejection.
It's exactly.
So I think the main message that we're trying to get across is we don't agree on what the difference between major and minor revisions are. And so, don't assume that the editor and the authors will know what you mean when you say major or minor. It's a combination, I think, of asking the editor for clarification and then also being prepared to explain what you mean when you say major or minor revision when you deliver your review. All right, well, that was step one, sort of establish, make sure that you understand the criteria and what it is that you're doing. Step two is when you actually get into things, and our recommendation, or mine especially, is read everything. Don't start writing comments
on the first pass. Oh, it's so difficult, though.
I know. Don't start copy editing.
You always get stuck. You start reading. Oh, no, they misspelled that word.
No. It's not about spelling at all. It's about phraseology, and it's about connection between sentences.
Yeah.
And
that is phraseology a word?
Phraseology is a word.
Wow.
I thought it was a breakfast cereal.
How you phrase yourself. So the company that words keep, certain phrases. So if I don't see the connection between the first and the second sentence, or just get midway through the first paragraph and I find that the first sentence is just really off, then I find it so difficult not to go back and think of a suggestion for how that can be improved.
And that's the first impression you get of the paper, so that sort of sets you in a bad mood when you're the challenge, I think, is that because you said we should read the whole thing first, and I think that's a real very good advice, because the first time you read it is the first time you read it with fresh eyes.
Yeah.
So, and if you start going back and maybe they should improve this and blah blah blah, you don't get a fair impression of the overall paper.
No, it is really important, and I force myself, but it's also very difficult sometimes.
It takes practice.
Yeah. It takes practice. Yeah. So you need to remind yourself. Okay, read through the whole thing.
Don't have a pen and don't touch your keyboard. No. Just scroll. But I think the big reason to do this cognitively is that your brain works well if it can focus on one task. And if your one task is just absorbing the information and not also trying to problem solve as you go, you can build that holistic picture. And then it can actually make the review faster, ultimately, because once you have an overall understanding of what it's about, this is what I do when I do developmental editing. When the papers have already been through one round of some sort of polishing, language editing, before they come to me, but I don't edit anything my first pass. I really try to just get a full interpretation, because then I can start to say, okay, what are the most important issues? Where should I focus the majority of my energy? And then where should I focus on minor stuff as a later thing? Because the big issues are the hardest ones. I have to work on those first.
Yeah.
And maybe you can sort of make some comments saying that, so this is good, or I don't like this, or something, but not try to think of how to improve it, not giving specific things.
Just
but,
highlight problem areas. That's this is my strategy now.
Yeah.
If I don't get stuck, but at least I just highlight the parts where I find that I need to go back. But then another, if it's really difficult to get the storyline, if it's really difficult to read because language is bad, or connections between sentences are generally bad, and transitions are generally bad, then maybe I opt for a strategy where I just try to summarize what each paragraph is about. so that I can follow.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah. you know, otherwise I get stuck in one paragraph and I reread it because I don't see
mm-hmm.
what it's you about.
Try to extract the message from the mess,
yeah.
so to speak.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I like yeah. that wording. Did you just make that up?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. You should copyright that. I think the point, though, is that you build your own understanding of what the paper's mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. And I think you mentioned this earlier, Liana, about how the reviewer guidelines sometimes ask you to give some sort of holistic mm-hmm. assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that involves, I think, actually writing a summary of what you think the paper is about.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that the author can see it. They can see what your understanding was. And then that will help them just decide, you know, how to interpret the peer review.
It's super important.
Yeah.
If you get that echo and that sort of, yeah. you know, you get that. This is what I wanted to say. So then you know. And
I didn't understand that the first review I got back.
No.
I was like, I know this.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you telling me this?
Exactly. So what's up? This paper presents. Yeah, I know that.
Yeah. But it's actually really valuable because then if they have got, without patch writing me, of course, like if I start to see my own sentence structure in their summary, then I get a little worried. But that allows you then to sort of figure out like what do I need to look at now? And then once you've done the whole thing and sort of built your initial summary, I would think the next step is to start going in more detailed areas and looking at more elements of the structure. So things that you might consider looking at are like, if you compare the introduction and the conclusion, is there a match between them? You know, does the introduction raise an issue that the conclusion doesn't actually tie off? Or does the conclusion introduce some sort of new spin on the idea that should be in the introduction but that isn't? Because as a writer, those can be difficult to reconcile, I think. You get so into the flow of the writing that, you know, you're like, oh, my intro's good, it's done. Or my conclusion's good, it's done. I'll just go write the intro now, or vice versa.
So what did you say? So if the conclusion introduces something new, or the introduction?
Well, I was thinking, so either the introduction raises an issue that doesn't actually get resolved.
Right. That's the,
Or sometimes the conclusion will frame something differently than the introduction does.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are...
draw a conclusion that is not really a part of the research question that is as it's stated
sort of tangential.
In the... Yeah. So that's an important... I mean, that's the highest level of how to structure a paper, that is the storyline. Everything should, you know, come together in the end.
Don't distract your reader with a bunch of stuff that isn't relevant.
So
which isn't the same thing as discussing future work, right? Or possible implications or extensions or whatever.
Yeah, I want to get there because, you know, sometimes you get, or writers have the impression that I cannot introduce anything new in the conclusion, which of course you can, as in future research.
Yeah.
Maybe you will point out something in the conclusion, which is sort of the, you know, like a summary of the whole thing, but still it's a conclusion. So where do we move from here? And then of course that will be new. So that's okay. But don't draw a conclusion that is completely new and doesn't match your research question. That way.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, we also did this thing that we haven't mentioned and we haven't shown results for, but hey,
we draw the conclusion. Yeah.
So that's sort of the higher level detailed things. I think next is to start going into, you know, things like polishing and flow and, you know, do the paragraphs work well together? Can you comment on those things? And in getting into the sort of language editing stuff, that's easy, but it takes a lot of time. Mm-hmm. So what's really going to benefit an author is going to be the higher level, more cognitively challenging.
And then I received a review once and the reviewer had picked out one paragraph and condensed it and said, you know, generally...
I see this.
The writing should be more condensed and more focused. And
that's really good because it's very pedagogical that you pick out one and you give them a good example.
Yeah.
And then rework the rest of the paper like this.
Exactly.
Because that's one of the things when you're writing a review, I try to keep in mind, although sometimes it's difficult, that they're usually the people who write papers are PhD students.
Mm-hmm.
So you should be constructive and pedagogic. So they should learn something from it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and how heartbreaking is it as a PhD student to get your first paper just completely destroyed by reviewers who are... So thinking of it as in terms of like a teaching opportunity. But those are the things that you prioritize. Those are the things you emphasize. And when you write feedback, even if you say, you know, some of these things are more important than others, someone reading feedback will take something that is higher up as being more important.
Yeah. Yeah.
So think about when you structure feedback in a review, the things that are most important go first.
Mm-hmm.
and the things that are the least involved with like actually putting together a good story, a good argument, things like language editing, come last. The nitpicky things.
So you need to edit your review as well.
So most important are things like the big stuff, ideas and argument and the credibility of the results and the interpretation of them. Next, we talk about things like how the paper flows together and
The red thread.
Have the red thread and also are they consistent across all things? I like to look also at things like have they used the same patterns across all figures, for example? Do they, if they use the color, do they use the same color for the same sample in every data set? If they use some sort of code system, is it understandable? Can I follow? Can I deduce things without having to go back to the method section and look for an explanation? Can I give them suggestions on how they might streamline the organization of stuff? Because those are things that authors, because you know so well what your research is about, you might not think, it might not occur to you that someone else who is totally new to this is going to be super confused by your like 12-letter sample codes or weird abbreviations or whatever.
Or purple for this in one figure and then green for the same thing in another figure.
Yeah, that's like when you go to a conference and there's some, you know, they put up a slide that says a busy plot, but I'll explain it to you. So what's the reason? What's the purpose of making a plot in the first place? Why didn't you choose a different way of representing your data?
Because you didn't have time.
Lazy.
So those sorts of details. And again, the fresh eyes approach is what's really valuable here.
Yeah.
It's important for me as a reader to be able to see this in your paper. I don't see it, so maybe you could do this instead. And then finally, we go down to the nitty-gritty details. Most importantly, I think, is do language and proofreading detract from the readability of the paper? They should go through a final proofread. How important is it? It can be a make or break type issue. You know, I'm not able to work through your argument because the language errors are so substantial. You could send it back for that. We have some tips just in sort of general giving good feedback tips that we could run through. It's a really good idea to use I statements rather than categorically. The research is flawed because or whatever. It's like, I like this idea. I think this idea works well because it is going to be your opinion, right? A review is an opinion piece. It's not a factual piece unless it is, this should be an X, but it's a Y.
And really also, opposite from all of the advice that is usually given, I think, for academic writing. When you write a review, you can bring yourself into it.
I think so.
And it's a way of also not complaining about the author. So instead of saying that you forgot to write or you didn't express this very well, you can say that I have a problem understanding this paragraph here. Then you sort of take the edge a little bit off.
Excellent point.
It means that you are responding, right? You are engaging in a dialogue, an asynchronous written dialogue with the author. I don't understand how you found this conclusion from this set of results. I think you might mean this. I don't know, that sort of thing. Avoiding you need statements is a really good. You need to do this. You need to reorganize that. You need to add these references. You need to redo this experiment. All of that becomes...
Because you just hear, because you're really not getting anything, are you? Because you're generally unintelligent. It's a bit patronizing.
You can write things like, you make really good use of, or your results here are really interesting.
Positive stuff then. Then you can bring out the you.
And then if it comes to criticism, it's a good idea more generally to be, I don't think this explanation is sufficient yet. So positive praise comes in with you. It's connected to the individual, whereas criticism is more connected to with an idea or a thing. And that actually will make it easier for the person reading your review to take in your feedback.
And if you can use parts of the paper as positive feedback, or parts of the paper as a model for the parts that don't work as well.
This part is good. Take the other parts out and just copy this.
Something like that. No, but if you have two sections, for instance, in your resultant discussion, and one of them works well, then you can say, okay, so this organization works because it does it that way. You first bring up the main result, and then you discuss them, and they're really, you know, good transitions between results and discussion because you use the word blah, blah, blah. But in the next one, I don't see which are results and which are interpretations. So it doesn't function as well. Try to organize it a little bit more like the former, for instance. So if you can do that, that's of course great.
Definitely.
If all of it is badly organized, then, you know, it's more difficult.
That's true. I think the next big piece of advice is don't be a troll. So we see what happens with the internet and with anonymous comments.
Oh yeah.
You know, people who don't have their real names attached to things can write the nastiest stuff. Don't fall into that trap. Write as if your name were attached to the review. Write as if you had to read your review out loud to the person who wrote the paper. Be as respectful as you can and only write things that you would be fine saying to someone's face. Some people are much more comfortable giving harsh criticism than others, so obviously that will, the level of criticism will vary from person to person. But don't be a troll.
No.
Nobody likes it. It doesn't help anything.
Don't drink and peer review.
Some people get really friendly and happy when they...
Yeah, that might be.
Choose
that,
the right
But
drink.
That's probably not a good strategy either.
Champagne works
well. Oh, this is so great. It's excellent stuff across the board.
And write the sort of feedback that you would want to receive. You know, think about what's helpful for you, because I think that can help turn off that super critical part of the brain that just wants to go meh 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 mistakes. Okay, so maybe let's summarize what we've said. Said that that the feedback that you write should work to improve a paper. That's your purpose. I mean, that's really what it's to assess the suitability of this research for this journal, the quality of it, does it pass muster, but also how could it be improved? And that it's good to start by reviewing the guidelines, make sure that you understand the criteria. It's good to then read through the whole paper to build your own understanding of the piece as a whole.
Which can be difficult.
It can be so hard. Resist the temptation to start commenting in the margins right away, because your brain's going to get stuck in details. And your brain is much better at just working through big picture stuff first. Once you've done that, start to then think about more detailed components, the quality of the results, how the structure works, how the introduction and conclusion tie together, CARS.
Creating your research base in the introduction.
And then the suitability for the scope and audience of the journal. And then you can start going into more detailed things like individual sections and how they fit together. Are there inconsistencies that the authors might have missed? Are there errors that are obviously just typos, but that affect the overall quality of the paper? And then if you've got space and time, you might consider looking at language and spelling and grammar.
So this is good feedback advice.
Pretty much. I thought we could wrap up with a little bit of sort of just general thoughts to keep in mind. And I think the biggest one is that peer review is really hard.
It is.
And it doesn't, it gets, you get better at it as you practice, the more you do it, the better you get. But I don't think it gets easier.
No.
Cognitively, it's really demanding. Peer review is based on trust, and it's based on integrity. The system doesn't work if we cheat. The system doesn't work if reviewers don't hold their end of the bargain. So write as if it weren't anonymous, and think about making research better. It's not about making yourself look good. The final thing I would say is, if you're unsure or if you make a mistake, own up to it. Don't try and hide it. Retractions suck, but they're necessary. People make mistakes. Science is not infallible. Results get published. We used to think that fat was the enemy. Now we think that sugar is the enemy. Who knows what it's going to be in 20 years? Probably never kale. Kale will always be
both fat and sugar. Can be an enemy.
It's true. but ultimately, you know, dishonesty is really not cool. So if something goes wrong or if you are unsure, have the courage to speak up.
I made a morale here.
We need to end on a high note.
I guess that's it for now on peer response or peer
review.
Yeah. And then we'll have a whole new episode on integrity and...
Oh, we'll have like 18 episodes on integrity.
Yeah.
If you guys are still listening to us, who knows?
Right.
We're long-winded today.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Yeah.
Go write something.